Blog Talk Radio.
Bless yourselves, here it comes, because we're alive and blessed to stay alive by the Almighty Creator in Torah Chaim, instructions of life, Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructions of mercies. We're now in tuned and tuned into blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the higher inner frequency within the blogtalkradio.com network. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 571, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, Program Presentation 133. Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're now broadcasting live at 9:32 a.m., March 3rd, 2016, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. Program content will involve discussions on the following topics. From the book of Genesis, chapter 7, verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on this day, all the springs of the great deep were split and the windows of the heavens opened up. From the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, verse 33, the curse of the Creator is in the wicked man's house, but he shall bless the dwelling of the righteous. Teachings from Rambam. /Chabad Hasidus and reading from Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan, Stumman Work, The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws, which can be purchased by going to the link, the following link, www.kehotline.com, and then from there you just type in Rabbi Dr. Shimon, S-H-M. O-N, David, D-O-V-I-D, C-O-W-E-N. Our call number, if you want to be listening in live, or you'll hear us eventually, Bezat Hashem, with the help of the Most High, on the archive version, is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones peacefully and pleasantly. And today, the tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, written in oral Hebrew, Israelite, Jewish, written in oral Torah traditions. And last but not least, children of Israel and the children of Noah collaborating to erase hatred, jealousy, and competition not needed. But in order for us to go on with the shoe, we're going to have to turn down the music from Generation Redemption. Here comes the time by Rabbi Isaac. And sorry, Rabbi Isaac. Rabbi Isaac is the president of the Beit Mazal Shul, located at 1433 President Street here in Kesakar Heights, Brooklyn, New York, located between Kingston Avenue and Albany Avenue. And the prayer service for this coming Blessed Shabbat will start at 10 a.m. We can authentic Jewish, North African, Moroccan chanting to fuse together with ancient Hebrew, Israelite, Jewish liturgy. But again, as we said, in order to get on with the show, let's... Here comes the time, and in this case, we've got to turn down the music, as mentioned before. Oy vey. Okay, now joining me live is our co-host and teacher, student, advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of the Nesher Gadol, the Great Eagle, Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Don, and to all our listeners.
Thank you, sir. And we're going to go right into a letter that was written by... Oh, by the way, I just want to mention, I think it's my duty to do so. Today's program is dedicated towards the Refuah Shlema, the complete healing of my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Ben Esther. May she rest in peace, my grandmother, my father's mother, who is resting comfortably and is making strides from strength to strength in his rehabilitation at the Del Ridge Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center in Paramus, New Jersey, and also to strengthen the heart and soul and physical efforts of my mother, Maras Yiska Techia Bas Chayasar Aliyah Shalom. Chayasar was my grandmother, my mother's mother. May she rest in peace, and may they both go from strength to strength as two souls, or one soul in two bodies, as my father seeks to regain enough strength that he can go back to his previous living arrangement. Now, today's letter is dating back to 1951, written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the title to this letter is, Consider, Is God Really in Need of Your Worry, or Will He Succeed in Finding Good Solutions Even Without Your Worrying? Now, the Rebbe starts off by saying, I would like to reiterate something that I have said a few times. One ought to know once and for all that faith is not something that is meant to remain only in one's thoughts. It must permeate the whole of one's life. You are, without a doubt, a believer. So the very first point of belief is that God directs the world. And if he is capable of directing 1.5 billion people, and again, this was 1951, now we have 7 billion plus, Baruch Hashem, thank God. But going back to the context of this letter, if he is capable of directing 1.5 billion people, then your own affairs will certainly see the fulfillment of the verse as it is written in the prophet Isaiah chapter 46:4. And there it's written, I have made you and I will carry you, I will sustain you and deliver you. With that being said, the Rebbe mentioned to this person, however, until you see the fulfillment of the blessing, you've been given two options. Either A, you walk around worried in case, God forbid, the blessing won't be fulfilled, and then when the blessing's fulfilled, you will have a fresh worry. Why did you have to waste so much vital energy in vain? Or B, you will be staunch in your trust and faith in God that he will lead you along the right path and fulfill all the blessings that you have been given. And then, when you see them being fulfilled, in actual fact, you will be able to tell yourself, quote, just look how well I handled this deal. I didn't worry about things that were no cause for concern. So the Rebbe ends off by saying, you can be happy and you can fulfill the directive of the verse if you will strengthen your faith and trust in the Creator to fulfill what is written in the book of Psalms penned by King David. As it is written in chapter 100, verse 2, serve God with joy. Dennis, any take on the Rebbe's outlook on how a person should not think about, or a person should consider, I should say, does God really need our worries? Confident that he will find the solutions even without us worrying.
Well, I'm not worried about God finding the solution. It's the humans that cause the problem. And that is, if you have faith, you really shouldn't worry. Because faith means that you have God behind you. He is with you. And if you're practicing your faith, that means that you have confidence. You have confidence in the future. And that's what faith brings you to. So worrying is a fear that things are not going to work out. But if you have enough faith, you should have confidence that when you open a door, even though you don't know what's on the other side, you are prepared. You are prepared because God is with you. So if you enter into things that are unknown, you're gonna be on the good side of things if you believe that God is behind you. If you feel like you are alone and God is not with you, now I can understand why you're worried. Why? Because you feel lonely and you're on your own. But with God, you are not lonely. And if you're not lonely, you shouldn't fear.
Thank you, Dennis. And it reminds me, when you mentioned about not knowing what's behind the door, is a particular historical event in the life of the 6th Lubavitch Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak Schneerson of Lubavitch, who was imprisoned under harsh, falsified charges that were launched against him by then the communist government. And at one particular point in his jail stay, in a prison called the Spalerker prison, that he was told to walk down a hallway and choose a door, being informed if he chose the wrong door, there would be no staircase or floor to support him, he would fall to his death. At that point, he admitted in his own writings, he wrote a diary, a journal of his experiences in that horrible prison, because most people that went in didn't come out alive. But he survived it. He almost felt he was going to break at that point. And then, somewhere in the corner of his holy mind, he recalled, wait a minute, we have a tradition from the modern patriarch of the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem Tov, that everything that occurs in a person's life is a matter of divine providence. Fortified by that remembering of that teaching within that small region, wherever that thought transpired in his mind, he confidently walked down the hallway and opened up a door and was led to a room where, more likely than not, he was further interrogated or isolated for some part, if not for the rest of that day. It was a harrowing experience, there is a very, very interesting short book, which is called A Prince in Prison, which he talks about his ordeals as a fully immersed human being in faith and in Creator and the Torah of Israel, and how did he deal with communists who were mocking him constantly for his belief in God. That's just something that you opened up a door in my mind, Dennis, to just bring that story out. Because what we're going to talk about right now, blessed souls, is another door that we can walk through to try to understand that within one Torah verse, in this case, the book of Genesis, chapter 7, verse 11, I'm just going to count the Hebrew words here, in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 17, 20, in 22 words, which basically is giving a historical depiction of the beginning of the springing forth of the flood in the days of Noah, which took place over 4,100 years ago, there is a period in human history which we are living in right now, according to our oral Torah tradition, as it particularly is elucidated in a very holy series of books known as the Zohar, the Book of Light or the Book of Shining. But let me read the verse. In the 600th year of Noah's life, that's point number one, in the second month, point number two, on the 17th day of the month, point number three, on this day, point number four, all the springs of the great deep were split, that's point number five, and the windows of the heavens opened up. So there's 6 seminal points of instruction in these 22 words in the Hebrew, and in the English it's about, 38 words. So in those 38 words, there are 6 instructions in Torah, but we're not going to cover all of them. We'll just cover some of them. Now, Rashi, again, who was the primary elucidator on the Torah, mentions in the second month, Rashi extracted out from a book called Seder Olam Rabbah, The Order of the Great World, or the Large World, that Rabbi Lezer says that the second month, referring to the second month in the Hebrew lunar calendar year, known as Mar Cheshvan, according to another opinion, Rabbi Yoshua says that this refers to Iyar, which is the month that follows the Passover, the month of Passover, and Mar Cheshvan is the month that follows Tishrei, which is the month where we have Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, which more people are aware of, Jews or the nations of the world. So there's a whole discussion of how could the second month be referring to either one month at one part of the year, another month in the other part of the year. I'm just letting you know that's a discussion. I'm not going to adjudicate over this issue, just to let you know that such viewpoints can be held as valid, both points. It's not a black and white issue here, but that's just something for you to do more research on, Blessed Souls, where it mentions that the great depths or the great deep was split. And why was the great depths of the earth split? In order, as Rashi says, that the water should come up from the well springs from below. Now, Rashi then goes back to the words before the Torah scriptural literature, which says we're split, and says the great deep, because the verse really reads as all the springs of the great deep were split. What is this idea of the great deep? Rashi explains to us, the great deep is alluding to measure for measure. And he quoted in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, which is the chapter before this one, the evil of man was great. Now, we've talked about this. There was lack of civility in human society at that time. And Rashi elucidates tersely, extracting out from the oral Torah tradition in Sanhedrin, page 108, side A, that because the evil of man was great, they were punished with the great depth or the deepness by which the fissures were manifested deep in the earth to bring up the deep waters from under the earth to flood the people. But again, there was also the idea that the people were also flooded or drowned by the waters that would come down from the windows of heaven being opened up. So, there's actually much more to say, but we're not going to cover everything today, because the elucidation according to the inner dimensions of Torah in this teaching is almost four pages. It's almost five pages of elucidation, which we cannot cover in one show. I think we're going to go back to the various sections, various points in this verse. But next week, with the help, blessing of the Most High, Dennis, any takes so far on what we've shared about how we can see in a verse there are 6 points, and also there's some terse oral Torah elucidations on some of those 6 points.
Well, there is some discerning points that you mentioned here, Don. One is the word windows. I think it really means an opening somewhere, because I can't envision, my poor vision could not take that there's windows in heaven, because windows is a human expression, and we use it here on earth. I don't know what they would use in heaven, but I could accept that there was an opening. And things right. appeared through the opening. So the window is not a technical term that I would use. It's more of a figurative word, I would guess. The other thing is the great depth. What we understand from history and what we learn and read even today is that there's the depths of hell. So it's like in the bad world of hell, there's many, many different levels of bad stuff going on. So when you say in the deep is the forsaken, the unknown. We've never been there and come back. So you're describing something that's like on a one-way street, because if you go to hell, you're not going to heaven after you go to hell. So the other part was that... I'm sorry, what was that last point you made, Don?
That the great deep or depth was, as Rashi elucidated, was a consequence measure for measure. Since that the people of that generation, their evil was great, so that the retribution brought from them upon them measure was extracted from a great depth within the earth itself.
What happens is the relation to the depths of hell and how bad humans were behaving is somewhat relational, so that it wasn't just a cursory thing that humans were doing. It was a serious problem, so it required serious countermeasures. So those countermeasures, as in the flood and other things, to try to get the message across to the humans that you're not going in the right direction and you're not making the best of choices. So we can consider this as a corrective measure. So therefore, people should have got the message. And the other part is that you're bumping into a little science here, and that is that the center of the Earth is considered to be molten lava to a certain extent. So out of lava, we do not get water per se. So that even though 3/4 of our Earth is covered in water, it's hard to believe that if it was magma in the center of the Earth that gave out water and filled it. We believe that God created water on Earth as God would. I don't know how that is, whether it was instantaneous or did it rain, but God can do anything. So therefore, to say that the wellsprings created the water may be a more figurative term, in that God in all his majesty created moisture and added to the water so that it became overwhelming for humans. So we have to be careful on the details. The concept is not in question at all, but the details are not all inclusive to understand everything. On top of that, does it, after 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, millenniums have gone by, does it really make a difference as to what month it occurred in? Because this is a story that defies time, because it goes back to the source. And that is what we have to believe, is that God in his majesty did these things to the earth for the benefit of mankind. And I don't know if they were keeping a detailed calendar in those days as to whether it was the end of one month or the beginning of another. So I'm not casting doubts on any of this. I'm just saying that in the story and the understanding, the concept is more important than the details. You may not agree, but that's my opinion.
Well, I need to elucidate, Dennis, because there's certain things that I want to clarify. First of all, the technical definition from the Hebrew to the English of a rubos hashamayim literally means the windows of heaven, but it's not the first time that we will see in the Torah that a literal translation from the Hebrew to the English is actually a figurative or allegorical type of depiction of that scenario. So yeah, there's no Anderson windows up in the seventh heaven that were raised and then the water pound through it. That was basically. I'd have to do a little bit more research, you know, from other oral Torah commentators. Why was the expression used, or what the conjecture is why the expression was used? But it literally means windows, but it's meant to be figurative. Like we see an example there's a song of praise given to the Creator led by Moses and the Israelites after the splitting of the Red Sea and the Egyptians were drowned, that Moses calls out to 600,000 men and the millions of women and children under the age of 20, or women over the age of 20, as well, that God is a man of war. Now, God is not a man, and God is not war, but meaning the approach by which the Egyptians were lured into being drowned in the Red Sea was a, so to speak, can be understood allegorically as a military strategy to stop their pursuit of Israel. The next thing is the idea of the great depth. Now, at the epicenter of the earth, I don't think even from a Torah perspective, anyone's in disagreement that you have this molten lava or hot substance. I think what the verse is saying is not that the epicenter of the earth was split, but rather we do know that there are different types of wells, wells and arteries that run through the earth. It's just that the water was extracted from some great depth from within earth, but not necessarily did it go to the epicenter of the earth. And then the lava, or that hot substance or rocky, melted type of substance, was transformed like in a mystical way from hot lava to water. I don't think that's the implication. The other thing is, in the second month, well, The thing is this: we have to remember, Dennis, and bless those out there, that every word that we're reading, as we read from the scripture directly, we didn't read in Hebrew, we read just a couple words in Hebrew, but in the English, every word is a prophetic instruction from God to Moses. Remember, Moses wasn't born yet. Moses wouldn't be born for another 792 years later. So Moshe, or actually about 712 years later, would Moshe be born. So Moshe had no idea this was going on at that time, but he was told by the Most High, and the instruction of the second month, or the 17th of the month, is not something that was necessarily logged on a calendar date, although Noah might have logged it. But when we have these verses, we know it today, it's because God told Moses, this is what took place on the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on this day. Did it start at night or the morning, whatever? Although we're not talking about that particularly at what, you know, we don't have the hour, as far as I know, when the water started springing up from the depth or coming down from the windows of heaven. So I just wanted, there is, because it is a prophetical teaching, it is not a historical, I mean, it's a prophetical teaching which can be documented as a historical fact, but that's why we see that many different cultures around the world, I understand there's scores and scores, tens of depictions of the flood. Each one has its own cultural nuance, sometimes for the sake of ethnocentricity, sometimes just for the lack of knowledge, and they mythologize, they turn into a myth. But here we're talking about a depiction of event which is pure a prophetical recollection of what took place over 4,100 years ago. So I just wanted to respond to what you're saying, just to give you an idea how we look at it from the written and oral Torah traditions.
Don, there have been points in literature where some people have said the windows of heaven are really God's eyes. And it was figuratively being used that way. So that since he sees all and knows all, he's not excluded from anything. So he has to be included. So when we do those references from a human viewpoint, that we can see through a window, God can see through everything.
True. And because we've had a pretty lengthy discussion on this part, this verse, actually we'll have to come back to it, God willing, next week, because as I wanted to talk about, well, we'll just mention it very briefly because we won't have time to cover this whole elucidation. Because if we do, then, you know, we announced other things that we'll be talking about, and we have to talk about Rambam and the different levels of Chassidus, Breslov, and Chabad, and of course from Rav Cowan's book. And right after this teaching, we'll go right to Proverbs. So in the 600th year, I just want to mention how the Zohar, as I mentioned before, interprets this verse as prophecy. Referring to what? In the 600th year of Noah, is alluding to the 600th year of the 6th millennium, around the year 1840, where the gates of supernal wisdom and the wellsprings of earthly wisdom will open up. Now, if one goes back to 1840, or a year before, a year after, the decade that followed 1840, see, there were a lot of scientific advancements. I believe it was in the 1840s that Louis Pasteur, revealed the wisdom of pasteurization to prevent different types of sicknesses from developing. But the point we want to make in right now, just right now, bless those, and be very, terse about it, is that what is alluded to in the decalogging of, or demarking the 600 year of Noah, is that was alluding to what took place in 1840, which was predicted by the Zohar, which was written about 1600 years before, as the opening up of earthly and supernal wisdoms, which will be in preparation for the world to be elevated to the seventh millennium, which is universally acknowledged by the sages of Israel as the Messianic era. So we'll just leave it at that. Dennis, I don't know if you want to comment on it. If not, we're going to move on to Proverbs.
I can't change history.
Okay. Now, here's another teaching from King Solomon, which is very... Oi, just dropped my speaker. Which is very deep, and it might intimidate and overwhelm certain people, but we have to deal with this verse because some people feel it, some people don't. Some people want to make others more aware about it. Some people won't. And Here it's very black and white. In fact, there's no even an elucidation of Rashi, but we will turn to some terse elucidations on this verse, which reads in chapter 3, verse 33, the curse of the Lord is the wicked man's house, but he shall dwell, the curse of the Lord is in the wicked man's house, but he shall bless the dwelling of the righteous. Now, a lot of people, blessed souls I know, struggle with the idea, well, if we have such a perfect creator, why is creator involved in cursing? And at the same time, too, while it would be expected of the creator to bless, I mean, are we putting blessing and cursing on the same plane, so to speak, on the opposite ends of a scale in how to deal with different types of human conduct? Well, the answer really lies in, blessed souls, is who are we talking about? We're talking about a house or a dwelling where a person is engaged in acts which are evil. On the other hand, you'll assume we're talking about someone who is living in their own personal environment and engaged in good thoughts, in good speech, in good actions. And there is another rabbinical commentator called Matsuda David, where he elaborates what Rashi did not concerning the part of the verse, the curse of the Lord is in the wicked man's house, that all the riches the wicked man has accumulated represent God's curse because they will only bring harm upon him. So here we see the wicked person is not necessarily someone who is suffering, meaning they could be financially very well off. But what the curse is, blessed souls, is that they're taking all of those blessings. A wicked person is not just cursed, they're also blessed. In this case, in this scenario that we're talking about, the wicked person has been blessed with a great abundance of wealth. But what are they doing with their wealth? They're using it to hurt people, self-aggrandize him or herself, making life rougher for other people. So therefore, because of their conduct, they're accessing something which is not a blessing. Meaning the bounty they've been blessed with has now turned into a stumbling block for them, which they might not encounter in this world, but certainly they will encounter it if the consequences are such for them that they'll be blessed to always be wealthy. But in the world to come, on the day of judgment, they'll curse that money because it led them to hurting people. On the other hand, what is the blessing of the righteous? Mitzvah David explains, God will bless whatever is in the dwelling of the righteous, meaning the righteous person doesn't necessarily have to be blessed with oodles and oodles of money or stocks or property, but what is their blessing? That they have the sensitivity to bestow whatever bounty they have upon the poor, and they will receive the reward. So it's not just the creator's like throwing out a curse here and throwing out a blessing there. Is how is each person using their blessing? In the case of this scenario, the wicked person has been blessed with wealth, but uses it to the point where it would have been better off they didn't have the money, but since they have the money, that money is cursed because it's not being used for the proper purpose. And the righteous person who is not necessarily blessed with the greatest amount of money, whatever they have, he or she is using it to empower those who are less fortunate than them, whether it be on an economic level, whether it be on a spiritual level, whether it be on an intellectual level, whether it be on an emotional level. Dennis, your take on these matters.
Yes, well, to me this is all about bad and good, very simply put. And that is that our Creator is aware of these things. And I think the word curse in this particular thing is relative to the word devil. In other words, the devil is upon us. We know that. However, he doesn't just dwell in hell. He can dwell on earth. So the idea is that he can dwell in a house. There's good people and there's bad people. There's some places that are very bad, evil, and it may be in one house, who knows, and there's good. It's all a question of what's going to spread more, the good or the bad. So... Mm-hmm. It's among us. It's very hard to tell the difference. The Creator knows the difference because he sees through that. He is monitoring us and the devil at the same time because we have free choice and we can use it at any time. So therefore, without being aware that the devil is among us, we may inadvertently accept him or parts of him and think that we're doing what is natural. So the mm-hmm. idea here is that you have to be wary of what is good and what is evil, and you must check the house or the dwelling that you're in. Is it good or evil? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you have to discern between good and bad.
Excellent point, Dennis. And someone who was an expert in discerning between good and bad, truth and falsehood, was Rambam. What would you like to share with us today from the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides?
Well, today we're going into the Guide for the Perplexed on page 555 of the online version. And we're at the beginning of what is known as chapter 53. And I'm going to read part of the text, and then I'm going to stop, and I'll interrupt for a second. So the words he wrote in the Guide to the Perplexed are as follows. This chapter mm-hmm. treats the meaning of three terms, which we find necessary to explain. Hesed, that is loving kindness, in quotes, Mishpat, that is judgment, in quotes, and Zedigata, as righteousness, in quotes. Now, I'm going off text. I'm only going to talk about one today because you have to digest that one. And it's a short reading, but in the words of Maimonides, it's compact. So he doesn't write simple ideas and simple sentences. He includes a lot of things. And that's what I always liked about his writing, is the compactness of what he's including. Contrary to a lot of things that you read, Dawn, that were written by well-intentioned people, they have an intention, they have a way of writing to include many, many different things altogether because they don't want to leave anything out. While Maimonides, on the other hand, is by putting it all together in concise terms, he doesn't have to mention all those things because they're included. So let me get back to the text here. And that mm-hmm. is, Maimonides wrote, in our commentary on the sayings of the fathers, chapter 5:7, we have explained the expression hesed as denoting an excess in some moral quality. This it is specially used of extraordinary kindness. Loving kindness is practiced in two ways. First, we show kindness to those who have no claim whatever upon us. Secondly, we are kind to those to whom it is due in a greater measure than is due to them. In the inspired writings of the term hesed occurs mostly in the sense of showing kindness to those who have no claim to it whatsoever. For this reason, the term hesed is employed to express the good bestowed upon us by God. Quote, I will mention the loving kindness of the Lord, unquote, Isaiah 43:7. On this account, the very act of creation, of an act of God's loving kindness, quote, I have said, the universe is built up in loving kindness, unquote. That's from the Psalms, and that's 89:3. For example, the building up of the universe is an act of loving kindness. Also, in the enumeration of God's attributes, Scripture says, quote, an abundant in loving kindness, unquote. Exodus 34:6. All right, so that ends the reading because I'm only taking one of the three different things that he's talking about today. Okay?
Okay, thank you. I just want to mention that, yeah, there is, you know, every writer, every rabbinical commentator, which Rambam is one of them, of course, one of the most hallowed ones, have a particular style. Now, in the Gajra the Perplexed, he is trying to develop healthy foundations because he was dealing with a door that was perplexed with their faith when being, as they might consciously or subconsciously recognize, as with other ideas, say like the Greek teachings and the Roman teachings and Arabic teachings, whatever was the considered to be the height of human intellectual cosmic development, and he had to infuse it with terse teachings in Torah that many Jews might not have been familiar with. Of course, certainly how much more so by the B'nai Noah who didn't learn the Torah in the Hebrew and had to now learn it in an Arabic form for those who could read it. Well, so I would liken it like to this following allegory. When you make a foundation of a house, the foundation has a certain amount of feet downwardly into the earth, and then it must be covered over by other parts of the house, which will establish the house, and then it can become a commodity to be sold, and purchased, and lived in. The other teachers of teachings I've been elucidating and choosing from are assuming that people have a certain type of foundation. So for those who don't, might be lacking in one foundation or another in terms of how to approach their learning of Torah, it might seem so much amount of data as if they can't explain it with fewer words. They could, the style of their teachings with the assumption that those who are coming to learn their teachings have already advanced, so to speak, in their scholastic endeavors in learning Torah. I just want to mention that, Dennis.
I wasn't criticizing styles. I was just mentioning that the Rambam had a certain way of including things so that he was talking in a higher general attitude than most people would, because they feel like if I don't tell you before you open the door that you have to turn the knob, he didn't pay attention to the knob, because it was the concept of walking in from one room to another that was more important than how did the knob turn, to the left or the right. So some details will detract from the meaning of the concept. So he stayed away from those things that would bring us down to a lower level. So I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's the way he expressed himself.
True. I just want to mention too, but Dennis, when he wrote his halachic works in Jewish law, he got down to the details, especially in matters of, say, like, how does one recognize the new moon in terms of the sanctifying of the new month in the Jewish Hebrew lunar calendar. So I'm saying he also could be extremely, extremely detail-oriented to the point where one would read, say, some of his works in Jewish law, saying, wow, this is the same person that wrote the Guide to the Perplexed. You might not even recognize that it's the same author, but indeed it was. Okay,
well,
we're going for... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, let me just say one thing. Yes, Don, when he wrote about Jewish law and other technical details, he left no whisker unturned.
True. Now we're going to go... We've reached the point in the program where we're going to turn to some Chassidus. And, unfortunately, blessed souls, there are people who struggle in their endeavors at times to marry off their children. There are other people that struggle with their endeavors even to they themselves to get married. So, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, I'm plucking inspirations from a book that was not written directly by Rabbi Nachman, but by one of his students. But the idea there are those particular souls who something, whatever they've experienced a lot. And the difficulties and experiences they've encountered on their highway of life have made it difficult and heavy for them to engage in the act of finding the proper soulmate. And from the abundance of the bitterness of their heart and their souls, they stumble over a type of promiscuity, which I'm not going to elaborate upon, but by just using the word promiscuity, whether it be with others or with themselves, they waste their human energy on matters which could be better devoted towards the following action. We're not judging those blessed souls who have had a difficulty in trying to get married. We're trying to ask them, we're making a petition to them, please have mercy upon yourselves and flee to one particular unique place. And that one particular unique place is the place where you can speak out all of your heart, and although your heart is broken and life has become very difficult for you, but that one particular place you can run to is the Creator. Come to Creator, may be blessed, with your complaints about why have you undergone these type of travails in your life. You can even argue with him. Of course, the arguing and the complaints have to be in a respectful manner. And one of the petitions that Rabbi Nachman suggests is, how can it be, my Father in heaven, that I have no soulmate? And by way of this, I've come to something that, and a person has to now estimate how to relate that to the Creator. And if all of this is done with contrition and a broken heart, Rabbi Nachman goes to say, there's no way we can even measure, there's no even way we can express it in human speech. When a person comes to complain and supplicate before the Creator, what's going on in the upper worlds from their heartfelt petitions, I need to find a soulmate. And it's even, this matter is mentioned in a book we mentioned earlier in the program today, the Zohar Kodesh, the Holy Book of Light or Shining, that the Zohar, commenting on the Torah portion of Balak, in the page 195, talks about the virtues of the prayer of an impoverished person. And we're not talking about an economically impoverished person precisely, blessed souls, meaning anyone who feels impoverished from not having up until this, at any particular point in time, the experience of having a soulmate. So Rabbi Nachman mentions that a person should, so to speak, take up a certain corner within their mind, or go out to the corner of a field and come with various type of correct complaints to pour out one's soul before the Creator on the evil or the lacking in one's situation and how they feel so lowly that they haven't found their soul partner. And for the sake of the fact that a person is coming forth with a contrite and broken heart, King David addressed this matter, Rabbi Nachman continues, in Psalms 34, chapter 34, Creator is close to those who are broken of heart and crushed of spirit, and from those who are crushed of spirit he shall deliver. And if a person will make it this endeavor to constantly supplicate the Creator, to run to that place of supplication, it doesn't have to be in a church, it doesn't have to be in a temple, it doesn't have to be in a mosque, doesn't have to be in a Buddhist temple. It's that place where you feel you can within your mind. If, how much more so if you want to speak it up, but you can also think out these prayers. Make those prayers. Open up those channels between you and Creator. And don't be surprised, blessed souls, if the wellsprings from below open up, the great depth, and the windows of heaven are opened up, not to flood you and drown you in more sorrow, but to bless you and anoint you with an experience that every human being hopefully can experience. The joy and the testing of one's fortitude of finding one's soulmate. Dennis?
Don, this goes back to a subject that we started today with, and that is faith. If you have enough faith, things will work out. Now, humans were not designed to be alone. When God created the beginning in the Garden of Eden, he put a man and a woman together. Were they compatible? I don't know, and I don't care. Why? Because they decided that they were going to go through their future together. If you look at your mother and father, if you look at your grandfather and your grandmother, do you think they were really compatible? Didn't they argue and fight a lot? But they all had different fingerprints, but they were together on the survival basis on this planet. So there is a mate, there is an opposite, there is a soul person for you. If you haven't found it, don't blame God, you just don't have enough faith. There's always someone out there for you. And if you look at how many people are on the earth, you can't find somebody that you want to survive the rest of your life with? Is it your problem? Is it the problem in your head? Is it the problem in your eyes? Or are you changing your expectations? Or maybe you're not using enough of your faith, because things work out with faith, and time is a great healer of problems that you think you're going to bump into in the future. Everything works out as long as you have enough faith.
True. Thank you, Dennis. Now we're going to move on to some Chabad Chassidus. These are inspirations which I'll be gleaning from a book called Sefer HaErech in Chabad. It's literally can be translated as it's like an encyclopedic work or book of the teachings of Chabad Chassidus. We're talking about this whole idea how a human being is different from all other forms of creations. And there, Rabbi Yochanan, who compiled this masterpiece, actually pulled from one of the teachings of Rambam that it is a matter of Torah for us to recognize that we are different from all the other creations. We're talking about inanimate life, we're talking about vegetative life, we're talking about animal life. We as life, which is human, according to Torah, are different from all different other forms of life. That each of the other created entities in the world outside of the category of human being have a particular construct, whereas the measurement of their nature is something which they cannot change on their own. For instance, the example given is that, and this is elucidated very thoroughly in the oral Torah tradition, is like, for instance, the eagle. The eagle is considered to be a merciful bird. Now, what is the trait that, now you might say, well, he's a predatory type of bird. He hunts for fish and small animal life that crawls and runs upon the face of the earth. But the reason why the eagle has been identified from a oral Torah tradition, blessed souls, as a merciful winged creature is that, number one, the eagle of all the bird life can fly the highest. He can fly higher than the hawk. He can fly higher than the bluebird. He can fly higher than the oriole. He can fly higher than the cardinal. And the nature of an eagle, now I'm not necessarily going to say this, we're talking about the bald eagle, but the species of bird which is called the eagle, and again, I haven't learned what we're talking about, because there are different species of eagle, or this is talking about one particular type of eagle, or all of them, I'm not sure. That I'm not sure about. But the eagle, as depicted here, when he is flying in the air, will not carry its young in its claws, will actually bear its younglings on its wings. With the understand, and again, this is only something which would be known from Ruach HaKodesh, the divine inspiration, Rashi explains, calling from earlier all Torah traditions, that the eagle reasons out, let the arrows of the hunter enter me rather than my young. Now, this is all an allegory towards the Creator mentions to the nation of Israel, I bore you on my wings when I took you out of Egypt. So this whole idea of the parent being able to withstand the test, somehow if it were to be shot at with an arrow here, let's say an allegorical arrow, but we're talking about, again, the nature of a physical animal here too, a winged creature, a bird, the eagle, that the eagle would be willing to take the arrow and somehow, if it could land, even though if it's mortally wounded, would land at a place where at least the little birds, its children, would be able to escape to safety. I guess it flew into a tree on the top of a mountain. Now, a father, for instance, an example, is we don't identify a human father as being cruel or kind, essentially, as much as the situation will dictate what type of emotional attribute will pour forth from the father. For instance, if a child is acting cruelly to the child's siblings, the father's love for the child would be, I want to guide my child in the right way. So we wouldn't be surprised if the father gives a slap to the child, or if the child was going to put their finger into an electric socket, how the parent would in a last desperate attempt, would slap away the child's hand, and it might cause the child to cry, just as it would cause the child to cry if the father smacks the child, if they see the child is to hit its siblings and hurt them, because they've already been hitting them. So the action of hitting is not an act of cruelty, blessed Lord. It's actually an act of mercy and love toward the child, that do not put one's finger into the finger socket. Stop hitting one's siblings, younger siblings, because if a child goes, does not have the consequence of the parental guidance to stop them from hitting, no parent wants to raise a bully. So, again, this might seem way out from left field, this type. How do we compare the emotional construct or the behavioral patterns of, an eagle with a human being? But this is something that the Rabbi Yochanan wants to bring out in the Torahs of Chassidus and the Oral Torah tradition, is showing that a human being can intrinsically, on the spot, make the change, while an animal has been programmed from their spiritual DNA, from the Creator, to go in a certain way in the case of the eagle, as opposed to if the child is acting properly and not seeking to put their hand into the electric socket, or they're not going to hit their siblings, the father will not want to hit the child. Then if the parent were to hit the child just for no good reason, then we would say that's a cruel parent and they're abusing the child. Dennis, your take on these matters.
We are all under the wing of God. He takes care of us. Whether we fly on it or not is immaterial. God is always there. Faith is always present. So therefore, we're under the wing of God. And on top of that, there are animals and there's humans on the planet. Humans are predators. But at the same time, we expect them to be practitioners, according to Rambam, of blessed kindness. So how can we be predators and at the same time practice blessed kindness? Does it sound like it's a dichotomy? It is. But that's what it is. That's the difference between good and bad, and we're constantly making these choices. Now, when it comes to children, it is not good and bad. We instruct them because they don't know what is good and bad. So, therefore, the rules of how we handle children are completely different as what our expectation of adults are. So, yes, we love our kids, but we will smack them, spank them, castigate them, even take a little an object and whack their fannies to let them feel the pain, to understand that they shouldn't do this or it's a bad thing. So we can express many different ways to children, but we don't do that to adults because the adults can swing back or get mad. But at the same time, the adults are in a dichotomy of how can we be full of blessed kindness and at the same time hold back our predatory instincts? Now, we kill animals basically for a purpose. If we don't, then humans are the only animal, in biological terms, that goes ahead and kills without forethought. Well, we don't need a purpose to kill. We just make a choice to kill. But when it comes to other humans, we are beholden that you cannot take a life. So therefore, your predatory instincts must be held in abeyance because your kindness must be overcome the predatory instincts. So this dichotomy is a balance. And if you have enough, you will keep the balance.
Thank you, Dennis. We're going to go to our last. We're kind of crunching some time here, but that's okay. We can squeeze out a little more time because I do want to read from a very small section of the Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws, authored by Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan. And I just want to remind everyone who, if you've heard the previous presentations here in this section of In Search of Authentic Ancient Torah, that in this part of the book, Chapter 1, The Soul, from Rabbi Dr. Cowan's book, he's been gleaning some insight from a writer and a psychotherapist, Viktor E. Frankl, a survivor of the Holocaust, who in this section of the book, Rabbi Dr. Cowan mentions that Frankl gave the highest meaning-seeking, and affirming faculty in the person, a variety of names. So what are those variety of names of higher-seeking, affirming faculty of human being? Number one is spirit. Number two is unconscious religiosity. Number three is the moral instinct. Number four is the metaphysical need. And five is conscience. This aspect of the self is to be distinguished both from the emotionally and physical needy and expressive self of the physical person, as well as from mind or intellect with its quality of reason. Rather, this is the distinctly impelled moral self, which by its nature seeks to persuade intellect to transcend the relatively self-centered existence of the bodily personality. This aspect of the self is the highest and essentially the representative element of the self, in the sense, as Frankl puts it, that has body and mind at its disposal as a composite vehicle for the stances which a person takes towards the situations of life. Thus, Frankl describes it as the quote-unquote spiritual bear of the entire psychological, i.e. body-mind organism. Not only, as we shall note, does it rightfully arbitrate the basic assumptions and values external to reason, and from which reason proceeds, it also adjudicates the conflicting claims of mind, in parentheses, reason, and body, in parentheses, life, comma, feeling, and suffering, end of parenthetical statement. Reason can calculate the cost and consequences of action, but it is not for reason to determine which costs and consequences should be borne. Material happiness and well-being and life itself are values, but the extent and conditions under which they determine courses of conduct require the adjudication, of a higher consciousness. In all, though preeminently in major life challenges such as bioethical issues of abortion, euthanasia, or social issues of sexual morality and physical threats to survival, it resolves what the unified being, as an actor of life, should do, whether it should resist a particular pleasure or endure a particular pain, and for what reasons. And there, Rabbi Dr. Cowan mentions in a footnote, and for what reasons, this calls into question the most fundamental assumption of rationalism, human flourishing and utilitarianism and happiness, as indeed of any ethical philosophy. All criteria are ultimately its criteria, and for this it is oriented towards a higher law. Any take on these thoughts by Rabbi Dr. Cowan, elucidating on some insights from Viktor Frankl from his book, Man's Search for Meaning, Dennis?
Everything that's mortal on this planet is temporary. So if you're going to make decisions regarding your senses as to what is right and wrong, you must remember that it's still on a temporary basis. So the whole purpose of being here on the planet is to survive, pass the test that Isaiah has always mentioned, and that is that you will be in good stead and you will gain entrance to heaven. To do that is to make the correct choices with your free will here. But you cannot really rely on temporary things that are materialistic, that are not going to last that long. So why put your hope and care and trust in something that may only last a couple of years? You must look at the short run and the long run at the same time, and you must make the correct choices. It is not easy. You will make a lot of mistakes. But in the life, you must have things that are with you for your entire life, and that is, will survive. And we get back to faith again. If you don't have the faith, then what are you doing? You're using rationalization, your mind, to create a place where you are. And if you think you're going to be comfortable or you think you're doing the right thing, your mind is going to tell you, well, we're not that free. We have faith. The faith is something that some people say, well, follow your nose. Well, they don't expect your nose to have intelligence. What they're really saying is all your faculties and properties should be pointing in the right direction, so when you make your choice, you can live with it. Why? Because you're looking at the long run and not the short run.
Beautiful, Dan. So with that being said, we have now come to the end of today's presentation. We spilled over a little past the 60-minute mark, but that's okay. After all, we're producing the show. We can do that. With that being said, blessings, I'd like to thank you, Dennis, for sharing with us one of your most valuable resources, your blessed time here for the past 65 minutes plus. And before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to share with our blessed audience that you think would help them have a better day?
It isn't a better day, it's a better life. And that is, say a prayer occasionally. Why? We may be busy in our life, but we have to remind people and ourselves where we came from and where we're going. And a little prayer creates a little bridge to solve all our problems.
Amen. Thank you, Dennis. With that being said, bless ourselves, we're going to end off with our segue ending music by Brother David Dome. He'll be singing a song, which I'll say very tersely in Hebrew and then translate it, or at least the title to the song. Hodu Lashem Kitov, give thanks to God for He is good. And with that being said, we've all got to do good, even if that generates within you some anxiety or ambivalence or Ajida, but that's okay. Ateva tov lehetiv, it's the nature of the good to do good. Creator, eternal creator, is the source of all goodness. And part of his eternal goodness is that he put you on this earth to help you realize more than silver and gold is it worth. And may we come to find our worth on this earth in a way of a havachad, one love, goralachad, one destiny, kulon for all of us. Badarchi noam, in a pleasant way, darchi shalom, in a peaceful way. Lahamshich Bezer Shem Yisparech, to continue with the blessings of the Most High, to help us realize our divine image will help us get on scrimmage, and our Tzelem Elokim is no dream. That being said, it's time to get back home with David Dome. Hodu Lashem Kitov. Give thanks to the Creator, for He is good. Take care, everyone. Amen.